Good morning, Laurie, and welcome back to another episode of the News at Newton show. Today we have a very special guest, Dr. Tanya Richardson, who's an associate prof in the Faculty of Global Studies and Anthropology, and she has special interest in Ukraine post-socialist societies and environmental anthropology. So today she's joining us to give some background information on the brewing conflict in Ukraine and Russia. So my co-host, Jeffrey, why don't you start us off with the first question?
Okay, well, welcome everyone back to the greatest new show alive. Yeah, as Rajnia said, we have a very special guest today. We are lucky to have an expert come on the show. And as I'm sure everyone knows, we've been talking a lot about this sort of crisis between Ukraine and Russia, between West and East. And so we thought it would be time to bring an actual expert to really kind of break down how this super complex sort of situation is happening and why it's happening. So, Professor, I will start off with a sort of background sort of question about the Soviet Union, which will kind of help our audience sort of understand how this sort of situation kind of developed over the last 30 or so years. So, in your view, Professor, how did the fall of the Soviet Union impact the Kremlin's current focus on national security, most notably their numerous attempts to prevent their direct neighboring countries, so Belarus, Kazakhstan, Ukraine, to name a few examples, from transitioning into democracy and politically aligning themselves with Western institutions like the European Union and NATO?
Okay, so thank you very much for inviting me onto the show. I'd just like to explain to your audience that I'm an anthropologist and I've been conducting research in Ukraine, in Russian-speaking Ukraine mainly, since 1999. I am an anthropologist rather than a security expert or an international relations expert or a political scientist, but as an anthropologist, I read my colleagues' work. And so what I'm going to talk about today sort of comes a lot from the reading that I've done of other people's work, but also, you know, having followed politics myself. So I think it's worth starting with the Soviet Union then and what kind of a state it was. So it was a federal state made up of 15 republics. The largest republic, which dominated the Union politically and culturally, was the Russian Soviet Federated Socialist Republic. So each republic had some elements of statehood, such as a council of deputies, and each was recognized as having its own national culture. This federated structure of the Soviet Union shaped the way in which discontent with the Soviet system was expressed during perestroika and glasnost. This was the sort of name for a period in policy introduced by Mikhail Gorbachev in the late 1980s. And this included this sort of, this structure influenced also how the Russian component related to these and expressed its discontent too. So as discontent with the policies of the central Soviet government grew, some councils of the republics issued declarations of sovereignty. This happened first in the Baltic states of Lithuania, Latvia, and Estonia, but it's important to recognize that the Russian Federation, the Russian Republic also issued a declaration on sovereignty, and so too did Ukraine. So when conservatives in the Soviet Union tried to halt democratization and halt the policies of perestroika by holding a coup in 1991, these republics issued declarations of independence. And in Ukraine, a referendum on independence was held alongside its first presidential elections on December 1st of that year, on December 1st of 1991. The Soviet Union as a structure, as a state, was formally dissolved when Russian, Belarusian, and Ukrainian presidents signed accords, sometimes known as the Belavision Accords, in early December. So it's significant to note that the Russian president at the time, Boris Yeltsin, and many Russians wanted to keep Russia, Belarus, and Ukraine, what they call the three Slavic nations, together in a single state. a kind of federated state. But Ukraine did not want that kind of an arrangement. Ukrainian president, Leonid Kravchuk, his condition for signing the accord was recognition of the three states as independent countries. So at this time as well, the Commonwealth of Independent States came into existence that were made up of all the former Soviet republics, except the Baltic states, so except Latvia, Lithuania, and Estonia. Russian leaders wanted to create a common military and defense structure, partly to maintain leverage over these successor republics. And while a defense agreement was signed with Central Asian states, Ukraine did not sign on to it. So in brief, although the leadership of the Russian Federation wanted out of the Soviet Union, in part to be able to get rid of the influence of a central government and of Gorbachev, it hoped to replace the Soviet Union with another kind of union, which would enable them to maintain the dominance of Russia in the region. So Russian leaders' sense that they should dominate their region stems from their sense that Russia is a great power and should be treated as one by others. And in particular, the United States, which became the dominant power in the world in the 1990s and early 2000s after the end of the Cold War. So this idea of Russia being a great power stems from the status of the Soviet Union during the Cold War, when it had influence over Eastern Europe and other parts of the world. But it's also part of a longer history of Russian imperialism that goes back centuries. So being a great power means having a sphere of influence. In other words, having some kind of control over the internal and foreign policy choices of neighboring states. So many people argue that a great power will not tolerate another great power having troops or allies on its borders, right? And so this sort of is part of the situation with Ukraine. So in multiple forums, then the Russian officials stated that they should be treated as a great power during the 1990s, and this continues up until today. And Ukraine has a special place in what Russians want for a sphere of influence, in part because its independence was only ever seen by Russians as temporary. This is because Russian elites and many Russians view it as really part of Russia. So this discourse about Ukraine has become more extreme under Putin's rule, as there's been a shift from recognizing Ukrainians as a distinct people, as was the case in the Soviet Union, to the view that Ukrainians and Russians are one people. And while relations with Kazakhstan have been less troubled than with Ukraine, Putin has also made comments that undermine Kazakh's claim to statehood. So from the Russian point of view then, EU and European Union enlargement and NATO enlargement were threatening to Russian security. In many formerly socialist East European countries, returning to Europe was a priority in the early 1990s. So this meant joining the European Union and NATO, right? And both of these were on the agenda from the moment that these countries elected non-socialist governments. And this is because their countries had been occupied by Soviet troops during World War II. And in many cases, the Soviets had, through force, established socialist governments on their territory. And the Soviets also invaded Hungary in 1956 and Czechoslovakia in 1968 because they viewed the reforms those governments were undertaking as a threat to the Soviet Union. So the memory of this then led many in these states to seek measures to prevent themselves to being subject to this again. And it was also, they also wanted to do this though, because they witnessed the Russian government use force on its own territory in Chechnya to suppress an independence movement and also to help establish de facto breakaway states on Moldova, and Russian, Moldovan and Georgian territory, namely Transnistria and South Ossetia. Nevertheless, it is important to note that a new European security order came into place in the 1990s with European Union and NATO enlargement. And there are now 30 countries in NATO, and 11 of them are former socialist countries. And three of those 11 are Baltic states, which were once part of the Soviet Union. So the Russian leaders present this as overruling Russian security concerns and of taking advantage of Russia while it was weak and in crisis during the 1990s, right? And now that it's a strong state, it wants to renegotiate this order. I would like to emphasize that Russia did sign an agreement with NATO in 1997 prior to NATO enlargement, in which it agreed to allow NATO to enlarge to and have new members come in, as long as it did not put substantial troops on those territories. And it's my understanding that NATO did not actually do that. Obviously, these countries became part of NATO and had their own armies, but that it was only in 2014, after Russia annexed Crimea, that NATO multinational forces had added small groups to these territories. So it's important to remember that Putin was elected in 2000, and that over these 20 years, Russia has become an authoritarian state. It has basically shut down the opposition. Its main opposition leader is in jail, and his supporters have had to flee. Media is tightly controlled, and force is used to tamp down dissent. The dominant political discourse in Russia has shifted to a distinctly anti-Western one, one that emphasizes Russia as a distinct civilization, a kind of mix of East and West, and definitely not West. Democratically ruled countries next door to Russia are viewed as a threat because, particularly in places like Belarus and Ukraine, because they provide an example to Russians of what a political system could be. And they also provide a base for organizing. And this also means that having a more democratic kind of system makes it more difficult for Russia to influence the policies of these countries. In parallel, it's also important to recognize that since 2000, Ukraine has had two moments of mass protest. In 2004 and in 2013 and 14, that resulted in a change of government. The first is called the Orange Revolution, which Russian officials refer to as Russia's 9/11. And the second is called the Revolution of Dignity, and it happened in 2014. And it's this that provoked the Russian military response in Crimea and in eastern Ukraine. So a Ukraine that is democratic and integrated into the West then is therefore perceived as a threat to Russia by Russians. In terms of Ukraine's relationship to the European Union and NATO, Ukraine is not a NATO member. It's unlikely to become one. It was unlikely before 2014, and it's unlikely now. One of the most contentious issues related to the current escalation with respect to Ukraine is the fact that in 2008, at a NATO summit in Bucharest, Romania, NATO leaders, and I believe it was George Bush who made this statement, they made a statement to the effect that Ukraine and Georgia could possibly join NATO in the future, but they did not provide a membership action plan, which is what actually leads to membership. Still, this was a kind of critical moment in Russia's relation with the West. Hello?
Hello, Professor? Hello.
Oh, sorry. I heard somebody make a, would somebody wanted to ask a question or just continue?
Oh, I think that was just a little Wi-Fi glitch. Or something.
Okay, yeah. Great. Good.
Sorry about that.
So that's the sort of situation around NATO, right? So NATO membership in Ukraine was actually taken off the agenda between 2010 and 2014 by Ukraine's president, Viktor Yanukovych, right, who's the president who fled after the Revolution of Dignity. Most Ukrainians up until that point did not support joining NATO, but that changed when Russia annexed Crimea and provided military support for separatist movements in eastern Ukraine. Ukraine is also not a European Union member state. And although it has asked for membership in the past, for a membership plan in the past, it has not been offered one and is also unlikely to be offered one. It does have an associative member agreement, which is effectively a free trade agreement and an agreement for visa-free travel for Ukrainians to EU member states. This agreement was due to be signed in 2013, but Ukraine's president at the time, Viktor Yanukovych, decided not to sign it at the very last minute. He planned to sign it, but then did an about face and didn't. Instead, he cut a deal with Putin, who offered money and other kinds of conditions, who wanted Ukraine to join the Eurasian Union. And it was this act, not signing this Associative Member Agreement Act, that provoked the Maidan protests, which eventually led to his fleeing the country. So once again, Ukraine's integration into the West has been a threat to Putin until military aggression was used in 2014. Many Ukrainians supported having good relations with European Union and Russia, right? And its leaders have tried to balance this out. But this is not what Putin wanted. So that's kind of what I have for you there.
So I noticed that you had said that Russia has kind of had a history of wanting to influence Ukraine's policies. And I was wondering if you meant that Ukraine being a democratic government that kind of has close relations to the West is threatening to the Russian government because it shows the people that this can actually be possible, or is it more in terms of like allyships that can be created by the fact that Ukraine has allies with the West? Or like favorable relations with the West?
I think it is probably, there's probably both of those are true, actually. I think mm-hmm. there's probably a security dimension to it, but it's also tied up with having democratic forms of rule because they're less amenable to influence. And they're also, if you're an autocrat, they're the model that they provide to your own citizens is can be problematic as well, right? And they're because Russians and Ukrainians speak similar languages, because there's a lot of mm-hmm. media in Ukrainian and Russian, then Russians can access this. It's sort of seen as a potential way to influence affairs in Russia.
Yeah, so I guess the one of Putin's fears could probably be something that, like, Russians who consume a lot of Ukrainian media and notice how things are going on there could maybe start protests and start demanding change in Russia itself. Would that be a reasonable fear?
Yes, yeah, I think so. And these protest movements that happened mm-hmm. in Ukraine, right? I mean, Putin presents them as being fomented by the West, mm-hmm. and that you presents Ukrainians as having no kind of agency in them, but it, at the same time, his kind of reaction to that sort of suggests that perhaps they do actually provide models for Russians to think with, and there were actually quite significant protests in Russia in 2011-12 were clamped down on, but they were quite prominent in Russia, and he sort of viewed them as being fomented by the West and drawing on some of these same sort of technologies or techniques that were used by protesters in Ukraine.
If I was just, yeah. Just to jump in real quick, just to give people, our listeners, kind of perspective, and because I know a lot of people are kind of like anti-Russia, anti-Putin, which is fair because he's autocratic, he's done a lot of bad things, but kind of what's currently going on in Russia is extremely similar to how the U.S. dealt with Cuba, with the Cuban Missile Crisis, and it's very similar to also how they dealt with, I believe it was Nicaragua, where they sent in troops. The point being that any major power in the world, their power is very dependent upon their security, their national security, and if you have neighbors that are kind of going against your sort of political alignment, that is kind of intrinsically a problem for any world power. Like, look at China and Taiwan, for example. But yeah, Professor, if I could ask you one more question, I guess I'll just ask you one more question because the last question was so well answered that it kind of covered basically almost anything I could even think to ask. But I'll just ask one more just for a little more focus on Ukraine itself. So in your opinion, how have sort of the changing geographic and political identities within Ukraine, so most notably cities and territories with significant Russian population, such as Donetsk, Luhansk, and Odessa, for example, contributed sort of to this current crisis within Ukraine?
Great. Yeah, thank you for that question. So if we're talking about the escalation that began last spring and that intensified this fall with the Russian military buildup on Ukraine's border, then I would say that the regional differences in the part of Ukraine still controlled by the Ukrainian government did not play a significant role. And in fact, likely the opposite may be the case, right? So Putin may be making a move in part because he sensed that Ukraine is sort of more consolidated and drifting westward, right? So I mentioned Volodymyr Zelensky, who was this Russian-speaking Jewish comedian elected in 2019. He was elected with this large majority from across the country. And although his support has fallen, it's still fairly strong. And it is very, very much, his government is very much is a legitimate government in Ukraine. He came to power on a platform of trying to negotiate a peace settlement with Russia. The existing framework for doing so is an agreement called Minsk II. So it was signed in February 2015 in the Belarusian capital of Minsk after a battle between Ukrainian armed forces and the Russian-backed separatists, right, where the Russian army had helped the separatists gain more territory. So this agreement is, the agreement signed is very unfavorable to Ukraine. And if it's implemented, it does give Russia basically control over Ukraine's foreign policy. And this is because it would institutionalize the Donetsk and the Luhansk People's Republics inside of Ukraine and effectively give them a veto over foreign policy, right? And Russia has a huge sway over those governments. And so effectively Russia would have sway over Ukrainian foreign policy. But Zelensky realized that the Russians would not move on this and that if Minsk II were implemented, there would be an uprising in Ukraine. Minsk also, this agreement also set terms for elections in the People's Republic and set the provision that there be international observers from many different countries, and there weren't, right? Russia has also since given all residents Russian passports. So implementing Minsk II would mean giving Russia a really large degree of control over Ukraine. And then another important event is that at the beginning of 2021, Zelensky's government decided to crack down on Putin's key ally in Ukraine, and that is Viktor Medvedchuk, who is at the far end of the pro-Russian spectrum in Ukraine, right? So he had begun to buy up media in Ukraine and was promoting a very strong pro-Russian line in Ukraine. So Zelensky shut down these media and put Medvedchuk under house arrest. And it was not long after this that the military buildup on Ukraine's borders began. So the regional diversity that your question refers to is very important, but in my view, it is less intense on the territory controlled by the Ukrainian government than it was prior to 2014, which is when Russia annexed Crimea and when the Donetsk and Luhansk People's Republics were established. So let me say also that it's very important to distinguish between ethnic Russians and between Russian speakers of various nationalities, right? For Putin, a Russian speaker is a Russian, right? He conflates those two. But in Ukraine, there are significant numbers of Ukrainians whose first language and whose daily speech is Russian, right? And who think of themselves first and foremost as citizens of Ukraine, and they are supporters of Ukrainian sovereignty and independence. In 2014, Crimea was, I believe, the only territory of Ukraine where ethnic Russians were in the majority, and they had just a small majority there. It's also important to remember that in Crimea, there are a large population of Crimean Tatars. Right, so these are Sunni Muslim people who were deported by Stalin after World War II. And who returned in the 1990s. There are, I think, 300,000 of them. There are also significant populations of ethnic Russians in parts of Donetsk and Luhansk Oblast. But it's important to note that ethnic Russians were not the majority here, even though most people, the dominant language was Russian. Putin has used these arguments about the oppression of Russian compatriots to justify military aggression. And Crimea was annexed illegally in 2014 with using some of these arguments, right? So unmarked Russian military forces left their bases in the Crimean Peninsula, took over administrative buildings, including Crimea's parliament, and held a referendum. So this was the first annexation of territory and changing of international borders in Europe with the use of force since World War II. So this language of Russian compatriots was also used to justify supporting groups of people in the south and the east of the country in 2014. I do want to say that regional identities and diversity does matter. And in this period in 2014, after the annexation of Crimea, it was in the heavy industrial areas of Donbass, which straddles both the Luhansk and the Donetsk regions of Ukraine, that is a strong, fairly strong separatist movement grew. That led to the proclamation and establishment of the Luhansk and the Donetsk People's Republics, right? So they have proclaimed independence. They've not been absorbed into the Russian Federation, unlike Crimea. And that's because Russia wanted them to be reinserted into Ukraine and to be able to influence Ukraine's politics in that way. So President Yanukovych, who fled the country in 2014 after the Maidan protests, was from this region, from Donetsk. There were in this region a wide range of groups that objected to the protests in Kyiv, and with the way in which they had led to Yanukovych's flight and new elections and a new government. And many of them, though, it's important to know, were oriented towards the region and first and foremost, and then to Russia, right? In the decades leading up to the election of Zelensky, Ukrainian presidents had alternated between more pro-Western and more Russian-friendly stances, right? And this was due to an electorate that was regionalized, right? With the center and west of the country supporting a more Western orientation, and the east and the south supporting a more Russia-friendly orientation. So in saying Russia friendly, I want to emphasize that all presidents, Yanukovych included, wanted to retain Ukraine as a sovereign state. So to summarize then, regional differences were very important in Ukrainian politics up until 2014. But Russia's use of force in annexing Crimea and in the Donbass war has actually led to muting of these differences. Right, so Russian-speaking regions of Ukraine saw what happened in Luhansk and Donetsk, where these regional leaders who proclaimed these republics were later removed and, in some case, killed. Right, so it's kind of even if they disagree with the central government, the example of these people's republics is kind of a negative one. But there's also been a shift in attitudes in the East and the South as well. Recent polling data shows that there has been a 20% rise in support for joining NATO in the southern and parts in the southern parts of the country over the last 2 years. Right, so that's quite a significant jump. So that's a response to the regional question there.
That was amazing. That was very in-depth. Thank you for that.
I just had a follow-up question to that. So you said that there was large groups of people in Ukraine whose first language was Russian and therefore would be considered as Russians by Vladimir Putin. However, they more identify as Ukrainian. So would they be Would people who fall into that group of being ethnically Russian but living in Ukraine, would they be more in favor necessarily of Russia's annexation of Crimea or Russia's movements to kind of encroach upon Ukraine's sovereignty? Or would that not necessarily be the case for all of them?
You're talking about ethnic Russians or Russian speakers?
Both, I guess. So Russian speakers in Ukraine as well as ethnic Russians in Ukraine.
So you're asking what was the case in 2014. So I think polling data has showed that certainly a larger proportion of ethnic Russians did support those moves, but definitely okay. Not all. It was not a direct correlation. That's important. But you know, if you're thinking proportionately, ethnic Russians versus ethnic Ukrainians, then yes, more ethnic Russians were in support of those actions. But it's important to recognize that not all, like there are ethnic Russians in Ukraine who are strongly identified with a Ukrainian state.
I see. Okay. Thank you for clarifying that.
Yeah, Fatima, if you want to just ask your question. Our last question, Professor. Thank you very much.
Yeah, as Jeffrey and Rajini mentioned before, thank you for the in-depth responses to some of the questions that we had today. My question, might come from a lot of people's thoughts in response to the whole situation between Russia and Ukraine. And so my question is, as Russia claims the threat of Ukraine, in Kyiv, in helping Russia's enemies and the need to protect ethnic Russians. So from this standpoint, Putin's geopolitical ambitions are unlikely to end in Crimea, as nearly all of eastern Ukraine is, predominantly Russian speaking. What is the likelihood of Russian efforts to seize further territory in the outbreak of the Ukrainian war?
Yeah, so very difficult question, very difficult to predict the future. So just a word, in terms of like the part of your question to me was kind of like, so Russia claims that that Kyiv is run by Banderovtsy, right? These are, and the word Banderovets comes from the last name of Stepan Bandera, who was the leader of the Organization of Ukrainian Nationalists, which is was a far right group formed in Poland during the interwar period. And then when Nazi Germany occupied Ukrainian territory, some groups collaborated with it, including the parts of the Organization of Ukrainian Nationalists. And then when the Soviet Union occupied Ukraine at the end of World War II, members of the Organization of Ukrainian Nationalists fought against it, and they formed guerrilla organizations, which lasted nearly a decade after the Soviet Union took over these territories. So Putin and others use the term Banderovets to refer to paint Ukrainians who have a pro-Ukrainian stance as fascists. So it's a term that's used to describe any Ukrainian but doesn't agree with the way Russians think things should be, right? For anyone who pursues a kind of independent policy that diverges from what Russians want them to do, right? So Ukrainian government is now, as like the president is Jewish, right? He's a Jewish Ukrainian or Russian speaking Jewish Ukrainian. So he represents the kind of person that in Putin's view needs protecting, right? Protecting from Ukrainian nationalists, right? So this is sort of to give you a sense of how you know, the way in which the kind of the Putin's view of things looks, right? You are, if you think in a kind of independent Ukrainian way, you are a Nazi, basically. But I just want to emphasize that large numbers of Russian-speaking Ukrainians and Russians don't want to be part of Russia. They would like a Russia that recognizes them as Ukraine so they can have decent relations with them. They're also not anti-Russian per se, right? Many of the people that I have worked with in Odessa, you know, they are very much immersed in Russian high culture, right? And for them, it's not a contradiction to appreciate that, to be a Ukrainian citizen and to not support Putin, right? But the other part of your question, and perhaps the one that's most interesting for you and your readers, has to do with different war scenarios. And here I can only sort of relay the things that I've been hearing from people who do study these kinds of topics. And, you know, there are different versions of what might happen. These range from a full-scale invasion, right, where Russian troops entered the country from the north and tried to take Kyiv and tried to change the government in Kyiv, right, or to take Kharkiv or Chernihiv in the north, right. This would be, and then to also come in from the east through the People's Republics and to move east that way, right? So the goal being to actually get rid of the current government and to install a Russia-friendly government, right? That would be a very costly scenario, in part because, Ukraine is a very large country. It does have a more experienced army, and a large numbers of Ukrainians are willing to join territorial defense units and fight against that kind of invasion. So that is sort of one vision of what might happen. The vision that Ukrainian officials are more worried about is actually sabotage from within and provocation along the existing front line between the Ukrainian army and the People's Republic's army, and backed by the Russians in eastern Ukraine, that there could be provocations along there to provoke the Ukrainian army, leading to a justification for a much more forceful intervention from Russia. There have been numerous increase in bomb threats recently, so there is fear of the use of that kind of action from within. And then you probably saw a couple of weeks ago, there was a cyber attacks on Ukrainian government website. And so there's fear that there could be greater attacks on cyber attacks, and focus not just on government infrastructure, but other critical infrastructure as well, to sow sort of chaos and to demoralize, to sort of make vulnerable to support to other kinds of provocations within cities, and to sow conflict in that way. And then if you watched the interactions yesterday in the UN Security Council, the Russian statements from the Russian representative there sort of alluded maybe to this kind of scenario being more likely, with a statement of, you know, the risk is that Ukraine will destroy itself from within. So there are different kinds of ways that this could happen. We don't really know what it's going to be like. Unfortunately, the person who most likely knows what's going to happen is sitting in Moscow. So all we can hope is that that there are still diplomatic talks happening, and that we can find some ways to that some ways can be found to de-escalate the situation.
If I was just to jump in real quick, I actually just got a notification on my phone from Al Jazeera. This is very interesting. So Qatar, one of the world's top natural gas exporters, will not be able to unilaterally meet Europe's energy needs should the Ukraine-Russia crisis impact existing supplies, the country's Minister of State for Energy has said. So that's actually very interesting. That gives Russia an interesting amount of leverage in the situation. But I think we're running a bit short for time. So anyone else have any follow-ups or anything?
No, I mean, I think Dr. Richardson answered her questions quite well, like in extreme depth.
Mm-hmm. Amazing, honestly, amazing. Thank you so much, Professor. Yeah.
Okay, well, thank you for having me. And let's just hope for peace. That's all I can say.
Yeah,
yeah, exactly.
Honestly. Yeah, thanks again, Professor. Thank you so
much. All right.
Thank you so much.
Thank you
for joining us.
Bye.
And yeah, see you in class later today.
Sounds good. Okay.
And enjoy the rest of the day. Thank you.
Bye.
Thank you.
Thank you. Bye.